Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Hundreds of unhoused people live in cars, trucks, and RVs across the Sacramento region. Those vehicles are often their only shelter from the elements. Last week, Sacramento officials faced criticism for towing more than 20 such vehicles, illegally parked following 72-hour notices. Businesses in the area have been concerned about the growing encampment, but the enforcement also left homeless families and individuals scrambling to find places to live. Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg said the situation was, quote, intolerable for businesses there, but was also critical about the timing and manner of the enforcement. In response, the mayor proposed an ordinance, one that would require the city to find housing or shelter for homeless residents first before their vehicles are towed. CAP Radio's Chris Nichols has been tracking this story, had a late night last night, and joins us to talk about it. Good morning, Chris.
Hey, Vicky. Good morning. It's great to be here.
So this went pretty late last night. Did the city, Sacramento City Council, discuss the mayor's proposal yesterday? And what kind of decision did they reach?
Well, they did reach a decision. It was only after a really long and spirited meeting, a meeting that included comments from more than 50 people, from business owners, parents, and advocates for homeless residents. And in the end, a majority of the council decided not to support the mayor's plan.
Yeah, I understand many business owners urged the council to reject Steinberg's plan. What reasons did they give?
Well, many said that the city needs to keep its parking enforcement rules. They said that's the only way that it can really maintain public safety. Christian McGlade spoke at the meeting. He said he's a realtor and a resident in the College Greens neighborhood, and he blamed some of the city's large camps of RVs and other vehicles used by homeless residents for an increase in crime.
We all want the best for our community, homeless or not, but I believe there are important factors to consider. There have been theft, car break-ins, drug use, prostitution, property damage, and human waste all in this area. Small business owners have taken enough hits, as we all know, throughout COVID over the past several years.
And we had the mayor on yesterday, and from the beginning, he's made finding solutions to Sacramento's homelessness crisis a top priority. What did he say to his colleagues at the council to try to persuade them to support his ordinance?
Well, the mayor tried to gain support by telling his colleagues that enforcement would still happen under his plan. Several times he read directly from the resolution. Here he is talking to the council.
Because it says very clearly that if we offer somebody another safe place to park and they say no, then we can move them.
He also said that this change would serve as an incentive for Sacramento to move faster, to build more city-sanctioned parking and camping sites for homeless residents.
In the end, though, the council did approve a more modest plan. What does that entail?
They did. They approved a plan put forward by Councilmember Angelique Ashby, and that will require monthly public updates on those efforts to build the city's safe ground camping and parking sites. Those updates will take place at the council meetings, and they will be posted on the city's website.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio's Chris Nichols. Chris, turning to another homelessness issue that you've been following closely, we learned last week that Sacramento County plans to extend a motel program that has sheltered hundreds of local homeless people since the start of the pandemic. I mean, it's called Project Roomkey. It's going to continue through at least March at three hotel and motel sites in the county. There were nearly 300 unhoused residents living at those sites as of late November, according to the county. You've been tracking this initiative. Remind us what this was set to accomplish.
Well, it's a statewide program, and it's run by cities and counties. And it started at the beginning of the pandemic and has provided shelter for tens of thousands of homeless Californians, all with the goal of protecting them from COVID-19. And it's essentially isolated them in these individual motel and hotel rooms. It was designed to serve older and medically compromised homeless people, people at the greatest risk of severe illness. And you might remember early on, there were a lot of concerns that the virus would spread rapidly among unhoused people. And Roomkey is credited with keeping thousands safe and largely healthy through the pandemic.
Roomkey was meant to last just a few months, though, but the county has extended it several times. Why do they keep the program alive?
I think for them, it comes down to the fact that there are still hundreds of people in these motels, plus the pandemic is still with us. And of course, the coldest months of the year are still ahead. For some perspective, the number of people living in Roomkey motels has gradually gone down. Of the 1,800 people served since it started, about 40% have gone on to either permanent or temporary housing, but hundreds of others have left the program without saying where they were going, and many are presumed to have ended up back on the streets.
Yeah, and that's a problem. So what are county officials doing to make sure these people get connected to housing?
Each resident is assigned a caseworker to help them find housing. The county has also helped some get housing vouchers. But of course, as we know, just because someone has a voucher, that doesn't mean they can immediately find housing. They still need to find a landlord that will accept them. I spoke with county spokesperson Jana Haynes. She told me that there are many, many challenges with Roomkey. It's expensive. It costs nearly $4,000 per room per month when you add up the rent, the security, meals, and medical services provided. And Haynes told me that this last group, the 300 people still in the motels, they include many older residents, many who are medically compromised or don't have the needed documents or the money to secure an apartment. And so she says it's difficult to find affordable housing for them and to maintain those services that they need.
And as far as exiting people out, obviously we're in a situation where the rental market is extremely competitive. The lack of affordable housing is an issue. And getting people the support that they need, it's not just about, you know, a roof over their head. A lot of these people need ongoing medical support. They need ongoing financial support. They need ongoing substance abuse support. And so making sure that they have the services that they need in addition to a roof over their head makes exiting people out challenging.
Yeah, $4,000 a month per individual is not sustainable. Were you able to connect with any residents who live or actually benefit from Project Roomkey?
I was. I spoke with a Roomkey resident named Karen Clark, and she is 68 years old. She's a Vacaville native. She told me she was recently diagnosed with kidney disease. She has lived at a Roomkey motel in Rancho Cordova since the program started, and she is very eager to move on to the next step.
You know, we have to do dishes in the bathroom sink. You know, there's all sorts of workarounds of, you know, it's a hotel room. It's not a home. For short term, it's, you know, it's been, you know, great. But, you know, 20 months in is, it's been really, really hard on me physically and mentally.
Clark told me she has a housing voucher and she is optimistic that she'll find a small apartment. But she also noted that open apartments get snapped up quickly. And so far, she hasn't been able to find something that works for her.
Well, thank you, Chris, for updating us on these important issues.
Thank you, Vicki.
That was CAP Radio reporter Chris Nichols. Up next, 50 years in local news, 50. We celebrate two longtime Sacramento journalists on their retirements and listen to how the job, really a passion, has changed over the decades. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Combined, they have around 100 years of broadcast news experience. For a few years, they actually both got their start working together in radio at KDVS on the UC Davis campus. A few years later, they went their separate ways, but actually stayed in the Sacramento region at competing television stations. Lonnie Wan would go on to spend the next 41 years as a reporter at Fox 40, or back in the day, Channel 40, and Jim Stimson would get hired at KCRA Radio first, then move into KCRA TV as a producer, executive producer, and assistant news director, spending the last 47 years at Channel 3. Both Jim and Lonnie retired recently. So we're going to tap into their wealth of knowledge of the greater Sacramento area for a conversation about what it's been like to cover our area during their distinguished careers. Lonnie Wong and Jim Stimson, we welcome you both to Insight.
Thank you for having me.
Does it feel that long after that intro?
Well, there's a couple of things. You know, when you cover day-to-day news, and Jim will attest to this, you tend to lose sight of the bigger picture a lot of times until you talk to students or researchers, and they ask you, you know, do you remember this story or that story? And then you kind of look at the bigger picture. It's usually nose to the grindstone on day-to-day news.
I would agree with what Lonnie just said there. It's, you know, you show up every day, you have jobs to do, and, you know, have some of the younger producers or reporters or assignment editors, and you start talking about something and you realize they weren't even born when you were covering these stories. And some of them, they look at you and they said, no, that never could have happened. And you say, well, yes, it did. Let me tell you about it.
Yeah. And I worked under you, Jim. And at Lonnie, I would see you in the field all the time. Right. Well, Lonnie, a graduate of C.K. McClatchy High, Sac City College, and UC Davis, 50 years in broadcast news, nearly 42 of those at Fox 40. When did the journalism bug bite you?
Well, I was an English major at UC Davis, and I got bored with going to class and was looking for something extracurricular to do. And I tell everybody the organizing meeting for the radio station, KDVS, was 2 days before the organizing meeting for the student newspaper. So that's how I ended up in radio instead of print, I guess. And it was a fun time. I spent more time down there eventually than going to class.
And the rest is history. Jim, I mean, same to you, 47 years at KCRA. And I learned this at your retirement party a few weeks ago. Obviously, you went to UC Davis as well, but you weren't planning on a journalism career. What happened?
No, I I had started out to be an engineer. I would go back. Television has always fascinated me. Just the word television was fascinating. And I grew up in Southern California near Pasadena. We used to go to the Rose Parade every year. And eventually, I got to the habit of sneaking away from everybody else and going to watch the TV production crews and all the work that went on behind that. I was just fascinated with. But jumping forward, yeah, I went to UC Davis to be an engineer, and that lasted about 9 weeks, just to the end of the first quarter. And I realized that there's a lot of math and science involved in becoming an engineer, and it just didn't stir my passion. And but broadcasting did. Yeah. The opportunity to tell stories and to have a positive influence on the community. Yeah, that's just been great. It's been a privilege.
Yeah, it's actually similar to me. I was an astronomy major, and I quickly learned that some things are hobbies and other things are professions. I was not very good in class. You both actually crossed paths as Aggies at KDVS, at radio, at UC Davis. Did you all get along? What do you remember from that experience as student journalists or students in radio?
Well, Jim was actually my boss. He was a news director. And just going back a little bit, there is no journalism major at UC Davis or any of the University of Californias. And so the radio station was run strictly by students. And there was just a group of folks that were interested in news and just started up a newscast. Others became DJs and played music and other kinds of things. But well, we were part of that group, and Jim was sort of the head cheese, if you will, of that operation.
Well, yeah, you know, KDVS was a remarkable place in that it was, as Lonnie said, it was run by students. There was no faculty advisor. There was nobody telling us yes or no. And we just kind of did stuff, and some of it worked and some of it didn't. And we kind of learned by trial and error. And I guess to the credit of UC Davis, they gave us a chance to do that. And this was obviously, this was during the Watergate era. And I remember we carried, you know, presidential news conferences live, courtesy of audio from KCRA. And it was just a remarkable time. And journalists were becoming heroes. And I think we both wanted a part of that.
Lonnie,
yeah, it's just been downhill ever since.
But, I always far point from to, it.
Yeah, surveys showed that back then journalists were high on the list of the most respected people. And then over the years, it's been going down and down. And I think we're below lawyers now, I think, in terms of the esteem people have for professions.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about the state of news and journalists today, in current day. Lonnie, you were actually the first Asian-American broadcast journalist in the California State Capitol Press Corps. You covered the administrations of like six California governors, beginning with Reagan. Let's go back to your first days or weeks. I mean, how did you navigate all that? Because press corps can be competitive.
Yeah, and I was sort of a novice at news to begin with. You know, I commuted to UC Davis, and so I covered a lot of the news conferences, governor's news conferences, on my way to campus or on the way back. And Ronald Reagan was still governor when I started covering state politics. And I would stick my microphone in with the gaggle of news reporters there. The Capitol Press Corps was huge back then. A lot of the major newspapers had six or seven reporters, like the LA Times and some of the San Francisco papers. I would just stick my microphone, hoping to get a tidbit that I could use for the station and some of the radio networks that we were affiliated with. And after a while, I sort of discovered that, hey, you know what? These guys aren't asking some of the questions that I need answered. And so just tipping my toe into the water, started asking questions of my own. And then I soon came to realize that, you know, I had a legitimate place there because I had an audience that needed information that wasn't being provided by some of these other correspondents from other cities asking questions. So that was sort of a boost to my ego and my confidence, so to speak.
Yeah. And it shows the value of local journalism as well.
Right.
Jim, you started at KCRA Radio. And I mean, I remember my first job, obviously. I think a lot of journalists do lots of learning curves. Why did you stick with it?
Well, because I just loved it. I mean, and I still do. I still do. You know, Lonnie and I actually, we worked together at KDVS, but we also worked at the Capitol as freelance reporters. He was doing more television stuff for Southern California stations, and I was doing radio. And back then, you know, we were just trying to eke out a little bit of money. You could get $5 for a soundbite if the networks ran it. You could get $15 if you turned a package and so forth. So you really had to hustle. I will say I got a lot of help from other journalists. They would kind of look over at you and say, you know, here, kid, get your microphone up in there or something like that. And just watching them and watching them in action. And that was a tremendous education. You know, one of the remarkable things about being a journalist is you don't need a license to do it. You don't need a journalism degree. You don't need a college degree. You don't even need a high school diploma. You do need some street smarts, and you do need to have the trust and the confidence of the people you're reporting to. But unlike so many other things that require some kind of specific training, doctors, lawyers, psychologists, and so forth. But even, you know, the guy who cuts my hair needs a license from the State Board of Cosmetology. I don't. That's a remarkable thing about this profession. It just allows you to kind of get in there. As Lonnie just said, get in there and stick your microphone in there and figure out what the story is that you want to tell. And I learned very quickly that when you would go to these news conferences at the Capitol in room 1190, and that was code for a news conference, you say, oh, it's an 1190 this morning. And what the person holding the news conference wanted to talk about was not necessarily what the journalists wanted to talk about. And that's true today as well. So a little bit of a lot of on the job training.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about more than 40 years of local news for each of you, covering like 16 counties. That's thousands and thousands of stories. I want to ask both of you, and I'll start with you, Lonnie, what are the stories that still stick with you, or maybe even some that have shaped you as a person?
Well, a lot of them are more recent. You know, the COVID-19 story continues to go on. And I count that as a big story because it is changing society, how people work, how people take care of their health, and how people view a government who's trying to get a handle on COVID-19. And so this is a historic moment. You know, a lot of times I tell people I've been lucky to cover these stories that are now part of history. And a lot of that history no one will remember. But things like COVID-19, the Northridge earthquake is another one that I covered that at the time was huge. People don't remember it much now. That was an earthquake, and most earthquakes are, but that happened right in Los Angeles, and it was too big a story for TV to cover because I went to places and other local news teams went to places that no one else went to, newspapers or networks or anywhere else, because the damage was so widespread. And you know, there's other things too, like the Oakland Hills fire. I could go on and on. But I think the things that that are more memorable are the things that transform history.
Yeah, because we're historians as well. Jim, what about you?
I would agree with Lonnie 100% that the pandemic is certainly the biggest story in terms of its impact on health, the economy, politics, the emotional fallout, the societal differences that have come to pass. I'm glad I was there to cover it for as much as I was there to cover it. And this isn't going to go away anytime soon. It has completely transformed so many parts of our lives. I mean, just this interview, ordinarily we would be in the studio and I'm sitting at home and Lonnie's sitting at home and you're in the studio kind of a thing. Beyond that, you know, the individual stories, the floods of 97, which devastated a large part of Northern California. And we were on the air for three days straight without taking a break. The Loma Prieta earthquake, the Oroville Dam emergency more recently, the Good Guys shooting, and even more recently, the evacuation of South Lake Tahoe because of the Caldor fire. And all of those have something in common because they're all happening and you're covering them in real time. And Vicky, you know what this is like. And people are turning to you trying to decide what to do. I remember we were, you know, on the air for the Oroville Dam emergency and looking up at our helicopter and you see this long stream of people evacuating the area.
For miles.
Bumper to bumper, yes, on the freeway. You know that they're listening to you either, you know, on their mobile devices or however, and people are making decisions based on what you're doing. And that's a huge responsibility. I remember during the floods of 97, one of our reporters was over at the State Flood Emergency Center. And I said, well, we're going to come to you for a live shot. He says, well, there's nothing going on. I said, well, there's got to be something going on there. He says, I don't really have much to talk about. And I said, well, come on. He said, listen, here's what's going on. They're all sitting around watching KCRA trying to figure out what's happening. That's a huge responsibility. And again, this is all happening in real time. We don't know either. The tsunami, when they issued a tsunami warning for Southern Sacramento County and parts of Napa County, we thought this can't possibly be right. And no. And then we get a hold of the tsunami center in Hawaii and they said, oh yes, there could be serious damage there. And we called the Coast Guard and Rio Vista and said, well, what are you guys doing? And they said, I don't know. What do you think we should be doing? And it's like, well, I guess we're all going to figure this out together. And those are really, you know, it's kind of scary when you're in the middle of it, but it's also just a lot of pride in the fact that people are turning to you and you need to be there for them. And
I think those are big moments. I think it's telling that at the State Office of Emergency Services, if you go to their command center, you'll see a bank of screens that are showing television news stations.
Yes.
So even the emergency responders are looking to news to find out what's going on in different parts of the state.
Yeah.
And you got to get it right. I mean, because people are making decisions based on what you're telling them. And that's a tremendous tool for any community to have, whether you're a little town up in Oregon or whether you're Los Angeles during the Northridge earthquake. And that's part of what I love about the job.
And in the newsroom, I mean, newsrooms are watching every other station in the area. Mm-hmm. You know, at KCRA, you know, you're watching 13, 40, Channel 10. I'm curious, Jim, given that you were in the newsroom as a producer and assistant news director, how many times did you look up at Lonnie and just go, gosh, like because of the competitiveness of getting there first? Was that competition fun between the two of you, especially since you started as college students?
Well, I never really thought of Lonnie as my direct competitor. He was more, he's
but
my
as
friend.
Stations, yeah.
And so forth. But yes, you know, people come through and look on tours and they look up and they say, wow, this is cool. Look at all the TV monitors up there. But when you work there, you look at it in different senses. Boy, I better not see something I like, you know, that looks better than what we've got. Or what are they reporting over there at Fox 40? What's CBS 13 reporting? What are both of them reporting that we don't know? Are we right? Are they right? How are we going to do this? And again, it's all kind of happening in real time during breaking news, but even on a regular story, you know, well, they're reporting that the mayor said this about his homeless program. Do we have that? Do we know if this is true? So it is a very competitive business. And one of the things that, you know, it has become more competitive over the years, Vicki, because there is so much of it that is being done live and is happening in real time. And you have to check yourself from time to time and say, wait a minute, everybody just stop. What do we know? Because as we've seen in a number of cases, it's very easy for things to spiral out of control and everybody starts reporting rumors. And what do we really know? And how do we really know that? And we've seen that in a number of stories, both local stories as well as national stories. So you got a part of your job as a manager is to say, everybody just let's stop for a moment and just do a check here and make sure that we are not doing this just to stay competitive with somebody else. And unfortunately, there are some stations over the years that have done that and reported stuff without attribution. And it reflects poorly on them, but it reflects poorly on all of us. It reflects poorly on the profession.
And Lonnie, this is where your experience comes in. I mean, being at a station for over 40 years, I think 37 of which as a reporter. I mean, for those who aren't familiar with reporting, we sign contracts. It can be a transient job. I mean, news in general. But you were at one station for over 40 years. That experience really comes into play, especially, I would imagine, when mentoring younger journalists.
Sure. And, you know, I did so because my family was in town and also the size of market that Sacramento is, because it encompasses a number of cities, it's considered a medium major market where you can actually earn a living here as opposed to a place like Bakersfield. Or you can move on, and a lot of people have moved on. But the advantages of being at the one place, you know, I used to marvel at reporters over at KCRA like Bill Harvey or Mike Boyd, you know, and Spencer Michaels, those veterans that developed sources over the years. And so, you know, I first covered Daryl Steinberg when he was a city council member like 25 years ago, and sort of followed his career, private practice into the Assembly, into the Senate, the leader of the Senate, and now mayor. And that's why I know him so well. And so I could, you know, get background information from him, as various other people that are now like chief judges and appellate court judges and things like that. And I knew them when they were just starting out on a school board or something. And so that's the kind of the advantages of staying in one station for such a long time. The advantage that KCRA always had with their veteran reporters who had worked at that station for 20 plus years. So, you know, and it's gratifying to see the community that you were born and raised in sort of transform itself, whether through, you know, expanding suburbs, new buildings, new businesses. And so kind of gratifying in that respect as well.
What makes Sacramento, Stockton, Modesto? I mean, those are the three main cities in our market, but we do span about 16 counties. What makes it so interesting to cover and also to report on?
I think it's always, for me, been a very good news town, you know, when you compare to other markets like San Diego and or any other markets around the country. I was at the museum when it was still open a few years ago.
In D.C.?
Yeah, D.C., brand new museum, extensive collection. And down in the lower floor, they had an exhibit of major stories that everybody knew about. And three of them were from Sacramento, the Unabomber, Dorothy Puente, you know, and I think the attempted assassination of President Ford. Three of the six major exhibits of big news was from the Sacramento area. So, you know, there's the political aspect of it, you know, the state capitol covers a lot of issues before they even go to Washington, whether it be gun control or abortion or other major issues, Prop 13. And then we have a rural component. We have a recreational component. We're close to the Bay Area where there's a lot of things happening there. So Silicon Valley as well as other things. So I always thought it was a good market. You know, there's a lot of crime here, unfortunately. Yeah, a lot of social issues because there is that combination of rural conservatives and urban liberals that are always kind of knocking heads. So I always thought it was a good news market to work in.
Jim, being that you were just from outside Pasadena, Southern California, why did you stay in this area?
You know, I never really intended to stay here, but I, as I've told some colleagues recently, I had the good fortune to land in a good place, a good TV station, and the good sense not to mess things up too much. And I think that I like a lot of what Lonnie said. It's California. California is my home. LA is a bit much, but when I came up here to go to school, I really sort of felt like this feels more like home, Northern California, and you know, living in a small town where every city, every town didn't just run into each other the way it does in Southern California. And KCRA has been a tremendous radio and television station. They don't have the radio anymore, but and that's it's, you know, it's as I tell people sometimes, look, there have been some tough times, there have been some bad days, there have been some frustrations over the years, but as I tell people, if you're looking around and the grass looks greener on the other side of the fence, maybe you should water your lawn. And that's how I took it. And yeah, Sacramento has grown tremendously. The whole area has, and has a tremendous amount to offer without some of the drawbacks that we're seeing in some of the other major urban centers.
You know, Lonnie, you touched upon how, you know, with misinformation and a dwindling trust in journalism, what advice do you have for someone young that wants to get into this business?
Well, I think Jim will agree with me. You know, the essence of the business is storytelling. And, you know, we could talk about broadcasting as a medium, but the basic storytelling aspect of it remains the same, whether you're on the internet or publishing a newsletter for the neighborhood. And so there will always be a need for good storytellers and who are adept at the technical part of it, using the medium, whether it be video or audio or pictures. Still pictures. And so, you know, I think there are people that will be always interested in that. And no matter the medium, you know, we've gone from newspapers being the primary source of news to radio, which was sort of big time for a number of decades, to television, and now the internet. And so things are always changing, but the need to be able to tell a story with emotion or with facts that is relevant to the listeners or viewers will always be important. So, you know, that's something to continue to pursue, even if you're saying to yourself, oh, newspapers are dead or television is fake news. There's always an avenue to get that kind of information out.
Jim?
Yeah, I would agree 100%. You know, whatever the technology, whatever the medium, there's always going to be a place for and a need for good photography, good writing, good storytelling, and good journalism. It's been disappointing and frustrating to see what's kind of happened over the past few years. And, you know, we used to go out and cover protests, just okay. And I covered a fair number of them in my day. But you know, when you're having to send out your reporters with armed guards in certain cases,
a lot of cases,
to cover something across the street from City Hall in downtown Sacramento. Yeah, you know, we just had a guard in the Bay Area that was covering a crew, help was guarding a crew on a routine story, and he ended up dead. That's kind of frightening. And you know, and Lonnie's out in the field, has been out in the field a lot more than I have. And when people start cursing at you and spitting on you, spray painting the camera lenses with black paint as they've done to us, and yelling fake news, you're just there to do your job. You're there to contribute to the betterment of your community by telling stories. And that's been disappointing, but you know, you got to take some of the rough stuff with the good stuff. And when you think about it, Vicky, we're all journalists. You know, when a kid comes home from school and the parents say, "How was your day? What happened? What did you learn?" In a sense, he's being a journalist, or she's being a journalist. Well, I did this, I did that. There's probably going to be a lead story. Maybe they bury the lead about that D minus on their English test or something, and kind of, oh, by the way, kind of a thing. But we're all storytellers, and that's not going to change.
Before we let you go, you've been out of the business, retired for a few weeks now. Either of you miss it?
I miss it all the time. For people who have been in the field, there's that sense of, you know, I guess I've always had this know-it-all mentality. You know, I've seen stuff and I know stuff that I want to tell you because I know it and you don't know it. And, you know, there's the thrill about going behind the yellow tape and talking to well-known people or even famous people that a lot of people don't get to do. So, you know, basically it's sort of a license to do a lot of stuff that the public isn't allowed to do. And that was, to me, fun. You know, people ask me about the effect of journalism on society and stuff, but the bottom line, what got me into this business and you know, all that stuff is important to me, but that fun factor was what kind of kept me going. The action, the things that are happening that you could tell other people about. I've seen it with my own eyes, kind of thing. And so that's what's kind of kept me going. And that's something that I miss as well.
Yeah, we're definitely not sitters in this business, you know? How about you, Jim?
You know, the first day, and the retirement has now been 2 weeks and part of a day. But, you know, waking up the next morning and grabbing my phone and not having 40 or 50 emails all of a sudden, it's like, oh, well, there must be, oh, that's right, you're not getting all those emails now. I do miss that. And right now, I guess this sort of feels like a vacation, except I can't go to a computer and see what we're leading with. And I can't, you know, look up something in a newscast really, really, really quickly. So,
because you would work on your vacation. We all know that in the newsroom when I was at KCRA. I think you went in the scripts when you were on a cruise one time.
Yes, I can attest that our newsroom computer system does work on a cruise ship off the coast of Honduras. But you know, it was late at night and everybody else had gone to bed. So, yeah, I'm going to miss it. I'm going to miss it a lot. It's been a huge part of my life and my identity. And, but you know, it comes to a point where you look at the calendar and you say, you know, maybe it's time to do a few other things that you like to do and give somebody else a chance to do what you've been doing. You know, when I leave, that opens a door for somebody else. And, you know, I will always be around to offer advice and maybe a little bit of criticism, but mostly advice and to help people. As part of when you get to a certain stage in your career, it's kind of your responsibility. And I think about those seasoned reporters when I was just starting out that said, here, get your microphone up there or something, or this is how we do things. And you really look up to them, as Lonnie said. And then one day you turn around and some of those younger people are kind of looking at you. And it's got a responsibility that comes with it. And that's true of any profession. So,
Lonnie Wong of Fox 40 and Jim Stimson, the assistant news director at KCRA, thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you, Vicky.
Thank you, Vicky, for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And congratulations on your retirements after each having about 50 years in local news. Still ahead, a lesson in the wonderful spectrum of religious holidays and traditions this time of year. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, from Thanksgiving to January 6th, it's really a festive season, a cluster of religious holidays and cultural traditions. We're going to devote some time learning about holidays missed in the mainstream, as well as learning about the historical origins of holidays like Christmas, Hanukkah, and Kwanzaa. Jeffrey Broad is a professor of humanities and religious studies at Sacramento State. He's also an author of World Religions, A Voyage of Discovery. Professor Broad, welcome.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
Well, starting off, there's a lot of nuance to this topic, and we're leading with an understanding of that while exploring the historical origins and interconnectedness of what are really distinct religious celebrations and cultural traditions. But with all of that in mind, I can see what drew you to religious studies. What specifically excites you about the field?
Well, it's a pervasive aspect of culture. Indeed, of cultures. And so the comparative nature of the study of religion excites me. I've often thought that if you had to choose one subject to try to engage in such a comparative study of culture, and indeed of different perspectives on how to be human, I think religion is, in my opinion, the ideal subject. It's also quite challenging to study from an academic point of view because of its subjective nature. And teaching is especially both challenging and rewarding. It's sometimes the case that students in class have take on more of a personal faith perspective than a purely academic perspective. And so that's interesting and challenging. And also in our scholarship, we need to be able to both be empathetic toward the religious traditions, but also maintain an appropriate degree of objectivity and neutrality, never denouncing a religion or condoning a religion, and for that matter, never denouncing religion in general or condoning religion in general. And so there are a lot of gears in the machine in religious studies.
I can imagine a lot of robust dialogue in the classroom. From Thanksgiving to January 6th, what traditions and religious holidays come to mind?
Well, I can go out on a limb, or you might say evergreen bough, and come up with a list of about 10.
Okay.
Or 12 if we include Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve as separate days. There's something especially festive about the number 12 for some traditions. And so I can offer a brief summary and going chronologically. The first one after Thanksgiving is Hanukkah, the Jewish celebration that occurred from November 28th at sunset through sunset on December 6th. There's St. Nicholas Day, celebrated in the Eastern Church on December 5th and the Western Church on December 6th. I think everyone knows St. Nicholas eventually joined forces with Santa Claus and became jolly old St. Nick. So this is typical of holidays of this time of year, that there are some intermingling, intermeshing. Bodhi Day, very important Buddhist holiday, celebrating the enlightenment of Gautama, on December 8th, that's the day on which Gautama became Gautama the Buddha, the awakened one. In Mexico, especially, and for people of Mexican heritage, especially, the December 12th marks the feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe, celebrated especially in Mexico at the Basilica of Guadalupe, one of the most visited Catholic sites in the world. Winter solstice, of course, everyone knows, and for some groups and cultures, it's an especially important day of celebration. either on December 21st or 22nd in the Northern Hemisphere, depending on location. Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, is, of course, on the makes the list. Boxing Day on December 26th.
That's right.
Yes, a British holiday and celebrated in former British colonies, including Canada. Kwanzaa from December 26th to January 1st is actually originally from California, created in 1966 in the wake of the Watts riots and a celebration of African heritage. New Year's Eve and New Year's Day. And then finally, Epiphany, as it's called in the Western churches, on January 6th or 7th. And then it's also called Theophany in the Eastern churches, celebrates for the West the manifestation of Christ as incarnation of God, marking the visit of the three magi or kings to the manger. And in the East, it's a celebration of the baptism of Christ, which is understood as the spiritual birth of Christ.
Yeah, when I looked at January 6th, I mean, the 12th day of Christmas, you know, Three Kings Day pops up, Armenian, Irish, Amish Christmas. So it's a pretty big day for a lot of different cultures. I'm curious, given that religions obviously are distinct, but is there a layer of interconnectedness through just common aspects this time of year?
Yes, I think so. I think that for the most part, these are festive celebrations, and that's certainly not the case throughout the year for all religious observances. Some are very, in fact, somber, sacred occasions. And these are, for the most part, sacred events, but typically festive. And I think that there is a certain commonality there. There's the more specific commonality of gift giving, which dates actually all the way back to pre-Christmas days, in fact, pre-Christian days in Roman times, the Feast of Saturnalia, which began on December 17th and celebrated the solstice and the new year, did involve gift giving. And if we look at the list of holidays that we've just enumerated, very oftentimes gift giving is part of the festivity, special foods very commonly. And there are certain things that come from particular places, such as the Christmas tree from Germany, the Santa Claus from Holland, that have permeated the celebration in all sorts of different cultures around the globe.
I can really see how just the road is endless for you. The academic road is endless for you as a religious studies professor.
There's nice job security in that. There is no true retirement, which is something I cherish.
Thank you so much, Professor Broad. Going through, I think, like a dozen cultural and religious holidays in about a 6-week span from Thanksgiving to January 6th. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, I would say thank you and happy holidays to everyone.
Yes. Jeffrey Broad is a professor of humanities and religious studies at Sacramento State. He's also the author of World Religions, A Voyage of Discovery. That's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Nick Dobis, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer, Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.